morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Emil Nakle. He is the author of the book A Necessary Engagement, Reinventing America's Relations with the Muslim World. He is a former CIA senior intelligence officer and director of the Political Islam Strategic Analysis Program in the Directorate of Intelligence of that agency. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he will be speaking about his new book this coming Tuesday, February 24th, from 5 to 6 o'clock at Garcia Street Books right here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So in the course of your research, you traveled to over 30 Muslim countries all over the Middle East, Asia, Africa, the Balkans, and you note that there are many sets of political and religious attitudes and ideas that kind of can be lost on those in this country who see Islam as something more monolithic. That said, describe, as you do in your book, the roots and the process of Islamization, which, as you write, refers also to a number of different manifestations.
That's right. First, thank you for your time to conduct this interview. As you indicated, we have discovered different varieties of political Islam. That was one of the main objectives of all those trips I took to so many of those countries, to assess the similarities and differences among Islamic groups and political parties from Turkey to Indonesia and from Morocco to Uzbekistan. And what we discovered was that there was a trend in the last two decades, a significant trend of what we call Islamization among Muslims in those Muslim societies. And by Islamization, we mean awareness of their Islamic identity at the individual level, and then trying to live according to the norms of their religion. And there were different levels of this Islamization. We kind of identified six different stages, if you will, of this this Islamization. The first three stages stay mainly at the individual, family, and community level. The fourth stage, where some activists move their Islamic identity to the political sphere, try to change, for example, trying to institute new laws in the education, judicial, economic areas that would comport with their explanation or interpretation of Islam. The fifth level, in a sense, where they move that desire to change the political system to make it more Sharia-friendly, if you will, Sharia is Islamic law, to confrontation with regimes. In other words, trying to, where regimes would not necessarily allow this political participation along Islamic lines, then you see a confrontation with regimes. That's the fifth stage. And the sixth stage, of course, is the terrorism. So what we have discovered is that there are many Islams, not just one monolithic Islam, that the Muslims of Indonesia are not the same as the Muslims of Saudi Arabia or the Muslims of Egypt or the Muslims of Albania. And we discovered that different Islamic groups have different agendas, but for the most part, they tend to be indigenous agendas, focusing on those countries in which they operate.
What are some of the reasons that people who really didn't grow up particularly religious turn to Islam in various ways? I mean, there are some basic things
right.
that don't have anything to do with religion per se.
That's right. Actually, that is one of the areas we try to identify for our policymakers. That's what we call the drivers or the factors that drive this Islamization. And these factors tend to be socioeconomic, tend to be ideological, and tend to be religious. so kind of categories of factors. The socioeconomic, for the most part, we discovered that many people who were not doing well, if you will, in the economic area, kind of underemployed, unemployed, people without sufficient education, and they tend to turn to Islam as an identity anchor, especially in the urban centers where a young man, for example, whether he is a high school dropout or a high school student or a high school graduate or even a college graduate, I'm talking about large urban centers such as Istanbul in Turkey, Cairo in Egypt, Tehran in Iran, Jakarta in Indonesia, Tashkent in Uzbekistan, major urban centers, they tend to lose identity and they do not tend to identify with their governments or their regime. So in a sense, turning to Islam becomes an identity anchor. Then you have the political factors, and that is mostly confrontation with regimes where, unfortunately, in many of these Muslim countries, regimes tend to be authoritarian, where power flows from top to bottom. It doesn't really flow to the bottom, but that it's mostly, authority mostly resides with the head of that country. They do not allow much opening for political participation and do not allow for political parties, civil society activism. So a man or a woman who wants to become more involved in the political process, when they find the door closed, they tend to turn to the mosque because the mosque becomes the organizing principle and Islam becomes the organizing principle for political activism. The ideological, the third category of factors, I would say, would be the ideological factors, and that is either global, that is people who tend to listen to Al-Qaeda or Osama bin Laden and who tend to identify with Islamic causes worldwide. In other words, to those people, what happens in Palestine or what happens in Chechnya or what happens in Indonesia or what happens in China for Muslims are not separate incidents or separate events. They are part and parcel of an Islamic cause, if you will. So that's what we call the global activist ideology. But for the most part, most of the ideologies tend to be local. That is either territorial. For example, Hamas or Hezbollah in Hamas in Palestine, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Chechen movement in Chechnya, the Indonesian movement in Aceh, Indonesia, the Islamic movement in Western China in the Xinjiang province, the IML movement in Southern Philippines. Those movements tend to focus on that territory, either for autonomy or independence or removing an occupation. So those groups do not tend to identify with a global ideology of jihad, with a global jihadist ideology, but they tend to focus on a domestic ideology that would redefine their territory according to their own definition of Islamic principles. So these are, therefore, ideological factors that drive these groups toward Islamic activism.
That said, what you said about their focus being local, almost all the places that you just mentioned are places where the United States has a very strong military and foreign policy influence. That has to play some role.
Right. No, I'm talking about the drivers of that ideology tends to be local and not necessarily even Islamic, really. For example, political participation, human rights, economic policies, anti-corruption, nepotism, and so on. These issues tend to be local and indigenous. Now, in most of those cases, of course, foreign policy becomes a factor because many, as you correctly indicated, many of these regimes have relations with Western countries, including our own, the United States, and those relations tend to be subject of criticism by these Islamic groups, not because of a specific ideology, but because of specific policies which they perceive the United States, for example, has done or has committed or has undertaken toward Islamic causes and Islamic countries.
Is Sharia or Islamic law compatible with democratic politics and participation in international legal structures?
Well, some of it is. I mean, if you talk, it depends. If you talk to moderate Muslims or radical Muslims, tend to say, yep, Sharia is the only correct democratic system of governance. That is, Western democratic systems are not acceptable. This is to radical Islamic activists, because they think that Sharia, of course, they believe that Sharia is divine law and it's God, divine made law, and therefore it has the principles of consultation or shura, and it has the principle of consensus or ijma, and it has the principle of allegiance or bay'ah, that these principles are divine principles. And therefore, they supersede what they call man-made democracy laws or democratic laws, for example, voting and elections. And so they tend to reject Western or concepts of democracy or our understanding of democracy. Now, that is the radical faction, if you will, of Islamic activists. But for the most part, the majority of Islamic activists tend to accept Western, if you will, or international law concepts of democratization and political participation. And that's why they have participated in elections. For instance, Hamas in Palestine, PKS in Indonesia, PAS in Malaysia, AKP in Turkey. Many of these Islamic parties have participated in elections several times and won some elections, lost in other elections, but they continue to participate in elections because they tend to take a more pragmatic view toward governance, and they tend to believe in this concept of electoral politics. So there is a clear division even within the Islamic activists, among Islamic activists, about the role of democratization and participation in the electoral process.
We're speaking with Emil Nakle, who is the author of Unnecessary Engagement, Reinventing America's Relations with the Muslim World. It's interesting, too, because you write about pro-democracy Muslim activists who have really mixed feelings toward United States policy, as virtually all Muslims do. There's not a positive feeling. But even people who are the most pro-democracy look at U.S. policy and see a very mixed bag.
Right. That's the point that I try to develop thoroughly in the book, and that is that the disagreements with the United States, according to all kinds of public opinion polls over the past half decade, the Pew poll, the Gallup poll, the University of Maryland poll, the BBC poll, the Zogby poll, these major international polls indicate that the disagreement with the United States among those polled in dozens of Muslim countries tend to be disagreements over specific policies rather than disagreements over values, that is, over ideas of good governance. For instance, several of those polls asked people whether they supported accountable government, transparent government, participatory government, and usually the response is in the high 60s or 70s in the response, that is percentage points, of people supporting these principles, where the negative attitude comes in when they ask people about specific policies that the United States conducted, for example, in Afghanistan, in Iran particularly, regarding the Arab-Israeli issue, in Guantanamo, in Abu Ghraib in Iraq. So those are specific policies which Muslims, and in fact, the Pew poll and the Gallup poll showed that majorities of non-Muslim in non-Muslim countries, you know, from European countries and other non-Muslim countries, majorities also expressed criticism of these policies. So it's important to distinguish between opposition to our values or to values which we think are representative of good governance and a specific policy. And that's important because if the opposition is to policies rather than values, then the low standing of the United States in many of these countries, the book argues, is reversible. That is, this low trend is reversible because 2 decades ago, we used to have a much higher standing in most of these countries. And the standing started going down, and the prestige and status started going down because of perceived policies that became negative and began to be criticized by Muslims worldwide.
And I want to get back to that in a moment, but you wrote something very early in the book that I found interesting about a conversation you had with a Turkish Islamist thinker who said that Turkey really had, you know, Turkey being on the edge of Europe, kind of the bridge between two worlds, Turkey had little in common with Christian Europe and should really look toward the Arab Muslim world for its grounding. And when you think about what those differences are, I think they're hard for many people to understand. They're hard for me to understand. What are the cultural, political, ideology, way of living differences that separate these two worlds?
Well, it's very interesting that you raise the issue of Turkey. That conversation was when the Islamic Party in Turkey was still not the majority party in terms of government, you see. And at that time, the debate, by the way, this conversation about the future of Islam in Turkey continues till this very day in Turkey. As you know, Turkey was for centuries was known as the Ottoman Empire, which was basically the center of the Islamic Caliphate for Sunni Islam, until, of course, the First World War, when Turkey was defeated, and then a new government, secular government, was established under Mustafa Kemal Atatürk in the 1920s. And Mustafa Kemal moved Turkey completely away from Islam and Islamic culture, and even the script, you know, the Turkish script used to be the Arabic script before 1924, and then after that it moved to a Latin script, because Mustafa Kemal believed that Turkey cannot really move forward and progress unless it moves toward the West. So that secularization was established in Turkey by the force of arms, and the military became the guardian of that secularization. Now that, of course, 80 years later, and of course Mustafa Kemal eliminated the caliphate in the 20s as well. And so 80 years later, of course, we see now that an Islamic party, which is a moderate mainstream Islamic party, is running the government of Turkey. And it's almost bridging both the Islamic culture, the traditional Islamic culture of Turkey, and the modernizing influences that Turkey has acquired from the West. So Turkey is an excellent example of a country where a moderate Islamic party can run the government and yet not run it according to traditional Sharia, Islamic law, conservative interpretation of Islamic law, but under a modern pragmatic interpretation of Islamic law. Now, the basic differences, I mean, between traditional Islamic law and Islamic culture is the role of Sharia. That is the role of Islam, Islamic law, in the daily lives of Muslims. Those who support that view believe that Islam is a total way of life. That is, you cannot separate your faith from your daily life, whether it's in economics, education, science, culture, whatever, that Islam permeates all of different facets of life. Now, the modern interpretation, which you also see in Turkey and in a number of other Muslim countries, is that people tend to separate their faith from their daily lives. That is, some say, well, okay, one can be a practicing Muslim, can fast and can pray and can go to mosque and can worship, but can also have a separate life in education and commerce and science without being totally controlled by religion. So there are these two different views. Of course, the radical paradigm that's advocated by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda advocates the more conservative and holistic view of Islam, where Islam is a total way of life. The more mainstream view separates between Islam as a religion and their daily life, where their daily life tend to be in accordance with Islamic norms, religious norms, that is, normative form of life, but not controlled by Islam.
You were in the perhaps somewhat difficult position after 9/11 of being in the CIA and providing a great deal of intelligence to the executive and legislative branches here in the U.S., and then finding that a lot of what you did really wasn't received. You were giving a lot of information that would suggest a nuanced approach to political engagement. They instead focused primarily on terrorism and took a pretty blunt military approach. Why this gap between what was presented to them and what they did?
Well, what we were trying to do in these high-level briefings, basically to inform policymakers of the context, that is, what is happening in Muslim countries. We, for example, tried to show the diversity and complexity that exists in Muslim societies. And, you know, in one of my briefings, I kept saying, you know, there is no such a thing as an Islamic world. There are many Islamic worlds. There is no such a thing as an Islamic street. And then I was talking about, we were trying to talk about the impact of education, the impact of economics, the impact of authoritarianism on these societies, and why do these societies produce activists who are dissatisfied and alienated from their societies. And it's those activists that become ready recruits for terrorism. Well, the fact is, after 9/11, policymakers were not really terribly much interested in that. They focused on the whole issue of terrorism, and unfortunately, they kind of painted the whole Islamic world with one broad brush, without any distinction between mainstreamers and what I call mainstreamers, that is, moderates, tolerant, mainstream Islam, and the radicals. And so this whole concept of the war, so-called war on terror, the global war on terror, became viewed in the Islamic world as a war on Islam, because according to our interviews and talking to hundreds of Muslim interlocutors, we got the clear impression that they viewed the global war on terror as a war on Islam. Those were the briefings that we tried to give to policymakers with specific examples from specific places, and knowing, of course, full well that as intelligence officers, we were not supposed to make policy. We were just our function was to inform policy, and we were only one voice. You know, they listened to other voices, perhaps it was frustrating, but we were aware of these two things, that we were one voice only and that we did not make policy.
What do you think the real, not the rhetorical, but the actual goals of the Bush policy really were?
Well, it's kind of very difficult to second guess, except when you look at the policies. The book talks about how the policies, how poorly the policies resonated in the Islamic world, that those policies, even without going into the inside the minds of policymakers, we looked at the impact of specific policies and how they were interpreted in Muslim and non-Muslim countries. And so, for example, and we were supported by a number of public opinion polls, and we tried to explain that the policies of the use of the military as a first resort was not all that effective, that invading a country without knowing all the long-term implications of such an act in the end did not produce much success. So we talked about, for instance, the approach to Iraq, the approach to Iran, the bellicose rhetoric against countries like Iran, and we try to say that many groups who were mainstreamers in Muslim countries would respond positively to initiatives by the United States to engage them. But, of course, such engagement did not occur, was very limited, and so what we discovered was many civil society institutions, many mainstream Islamic groups that were interested in being part of the political systems in their countries and were willing to engage the United States on democratic issues, on educational reform issues, on political reform issues and related social issues, that they were disappointed because the administration was primarily interested in seeing the whole Islamic world through the prism of terrorism. And the prism of terrorism was very narrow and did not really engage the wider Islamic world.
As you write in the book, a lot of people across the Muslim world, especially over the last decade or so, have gotten very concerned about the situation of Israel and Palestine. And Israel, as you have written, is not even drawn on the maps of many of the school textbooks in Muslim schools. Why the enmity toward Israel, and how much of that is related to the hostility toward United States policy and Israel's role as a client state of the United States?
Right. I think there are a couple of basic points that ought to be made here that we discovered in all of these visits and interviews, that to many Muslims, they focus on the Israeli occupation rather than the state of Israel itself. In other words, whether it's in the West Bank and Gaza, or before that in South Lebanon, or in the Golan Heights, or in Sinai before Israel withdrew from there and signed the peace agreement with Egypt, that they focus on the continued occupation and blockades, if you will, around Palestinian lands in the West Bank and Gaza. Now, the second point that ought to be made is that in our conversation, we discovered that most Arabs and Muslims accept American support for Israel as a given. That is, fine, they accept that. But what do they seek is a more even approach, even-handed approach, or what some said, the honest broker, which I quoted that, I wrote about that in the book. That is, they used to say, well, of course, the United States, because of its influence with both sides, is the only country that ultimately can bring about a peace settlement between Israel and the Palestinians and Israel and the Arab states. However, in the last few years under the Bush administration, public opinion polls clearly indicated that the United States lost that honest broker status, and it became viewed as totally supportive of Israel without any credibility in terms of reaching peace with the other countries. And that's why there has been a positive reaction to the Obama administration's interest and appointment of a special envoy, because the view now is that the Obama administration is very serious, it seems, according to what you read in the Arab and Islamic media, about finding some sort of a settlement in the Arab Israeli issue. However, as these writings indicate, that this bounce that the Obama statement since the inaugural speech, the bounce that they have created, would be short-lived if it is not translated into actual policy. And so this is a cautionary point. So during the Bush years, unfortunately, the United States lost that even-handedness that was always associated with the United States. And so the challenge now is to regain that status and then use it in order to bring the parties together.
We're speaking with Emil Nakhle, author of A Necessary Engagement, Reinventing America's Relationships with the Muslim World. So you have a number of recommendations for, as the title of your book suggests, engagement. And engagement is, by definition, not a military process. What are some of your ideas for how these relationships can really be improved?
We have recommended at least, and by the way, these recommendations, what I call them the blueprint, the 10-point blueprint for the new administration. These recommendations are based on a number of briefings that we made over the years. So some of them are not really new, but they begin with the appointment of an ambassador to the OIC, or the Organization of Islamic Conference. And we made this recommendation way back, several years back. And finally, President Bush appointed a special envoy to the OIC back in 2008, last year. But what the recommendation calls for is a senior person appointing a distinguished American Muslim from the United States, who would have an office at State Department and an office at the White House, who would be the main spokesman for the administration in dealing with the Islamic world. Because many, based on our interviews, many Muslims were not clear as to who was speaking for whom and whose message they should listen to. So the recommendation here calls for an ambassador who would be the main spokesman, who would articulate the message for the government, for the administration, in dealing with the Organization of Islamic States. Recommendation, we call for a dialogue with mainstream Islamic political parties. That is, we studied over 100 political groups and parties in all of these Islamic countries, and a vast majority of them, now there are a few radical parties who are not interested in gradual change, who are not interested in working within the system. Well, we are not talking about those. We are talking about the vast majority of political parties, Islamic political parties and groups. And we are suggesting that the administration should engage these parties, because if we are talking about democratization, let's say, or political reform in countries like Indonesia or Turkey or Egypt or Morocco or Jordan or Pakistan or Bangladesh, you really cannot talk about establishing those goals without engaging the political groups in those societies a majority of which tend to be Islamic. So that was a recommendation. Then we talked about expanding the educational exchange programs, university to university programs, establishing campuses, major American universities to establish campuses in several Muslim countries. There were some recommendations that perhaps one of which might be controversial, and I'm referring to the establishment of an imamate university, that is, a university in this country that would grant graduate degrees in for clerics to become mosque imams, to become like clerics in mosques, because what drives this recommendation is the concern that we've had over in recent years that many of these imams or clerics tend to be educated according to kind of radical courses of studies, radical interpretation of Islam, and so on. So this recommendation calls for establishment of a moderate course of study that would be developed by top American universities in conjunction with mainstream Islamic universities in Muslim countries, including the Organization of Islamic Conference, to bring in scholars to develop a graduate program and study, and then get degrees so that they can become imams, and those imams could serve in this country or in other countries as well. And so such a university would open its doors to Muslim students from other countries. The final, of course, recommendation is to engage the American Muslim community. In other words, if our attempts to engage the Islamic world are going to be credible and legitimate, we need to bring in the process, to bring the American Muslim community into the process, so that Muslims overseas would see American Muslims engage in the process. That would give the process more credibility, and therefore Muslims overseas become more receptive to these initiatives and overtures for engagement.
In a nutshell, a lot of what you're saying can be summed up as getting to know each other.
Well, yes. That is exactly the point, getting to know each other and getting to discovering that there is common ground, that there are a lot of common principles that connect these cultures. I mean, most people, even in Muslim countries, in our interviews, in one of the briefings I said, well, most of the people I interviewed are like us. They have children to educate. They have mortgages to pay. They have bills to pay. And so they are interested in daily lives rather than in religious doctrine, you see. They want to live. They want to educate their kids. They want to have to raise their families. And most people, according to these polls, showed that they are interested in fairness, in justice, in peaceful settlement of disputes. And so we cannot just say, oh, that they are all radicals or that they are all terrorists. So there are distinctions that can be made. And so the book basically calls for a sophisticated, nuanced approach to the Islamic world that is grounded in deep expertise, cultural, historical, linguistic expertise of those societies. And until we know those societies, we cannot really engage them, and we cannot know them all that well.
And as you say in the book, there are many, many educated middle-class people across the Muslim world, and there are also many people who define themselves as poor and weak and disenfranchised, but they're as connected even in their villages to the global world, and they're as knowledgeable as anybody else, including in the big city.
That is exactly right, and we discovered on our travels overseas, and my wife often traveled with me, even villages in the Fergana Valley in Uzbekistan, that area there that connects Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan and Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan and Tajikistan, that area there, even in very small villages, we discovered that you go into a little shop and you see that it's connected. It's wired. And, you know, when the shop is wired, you cannot even get good bargains anymore because then they know the price of those items, you see.
Oh, my goodness.
But then they tend to read. They tend to know what's happening overseas. They tend to listen to the news. They tend to get online. And they are connected. And so it's truly, you begin to notice that we are truly moving toward a globalized world.
Emil Nakle is the author of A Necessary Engagement, Reinventing America's Relations with the Muslim World. And he will be speaking about this book on Tuesday, February 24th from 5 to 6 o'clock at Garcia Street Books here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. We're going to take a small break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Jorge Garcia about Mexico and some of the rituals of Mexico that will be happening here in Santa Fe. Please stay tuned.